This session is conceived of as a part of the, part of a whole series that we're having this week on energy, ethics, and faith. And we had the first phase of it this morning at 9 o'clock, in which the Science Committee reported on its responsibility and its thinking about Holden. The focus of the Science Committee, as I understand, is not just energy, but it involves a great deal of energy, and energy is a very important aspect of it. And we'll be continuing these discussions at 9 o'clock the rest of the week. We don't know quite what the program is yet. There are plenty of subjects to discuss, but it will evolve. We may go on from tonight. And I'm just kind of convening this. It really is a kind of presentation of the scientists of the Science Committee, most of whom know a great deal more than I do, but I have attended to the problem of energy. I decided it was worth attending to for about 18 months. And just the way I think members of the household of faith, the people, the Easter people, need to begin to attend to things that they think are important. You can't attend to everything, and we need people who are attending for us. And I'm trying to bring to you tonight some people who professionally, in one way or another, have been involved in this energy situation. And tonight we're going to talk about nuclear energy. And I have Roger McClellan sitting on my right, and Leo Bustad to the right of him, and Dave Larson is back there in the post, and Rudy is somewhere around. Rudy is right next to him. And
Larry Collins is
there. Larry, and we hope to have Paul Haynes. Paul and I are kind of getting in on this because we're interested in it. But Paul has to go out tomorrow, so he may not be here. Now, I'm going to introduce the subject of nuclear energy by making a few remarks. They don't intend to be definitive, and they don't intend really to state a position, although I'm sure they'll represent a position which raises a lot of questions about our involvement in nuclear energy and the process by virtue of which we have just gotten involved in it without too much of a public discussion. Let me first say that in the light of the situation with fossil fuels, there's no doubt that we have to move towards some other sources of energy. And the question is where we move. And we are moving, and we will move, in the direction of nuclear fission because we have the capability. Now, I want to give first the arguments against moving in this direction and just summarize them. I'm not going to develop them. And one of the arguments is that there is considerable danger of a serious accident in nuclear reactors, in which accident many people will be exposed to radiation in lethal amounts. The system breaks down either due to physical defects or to human errors, that is, the actual reactor breaks down. Now, if the risks are small, as is suggested by Norman Rasmussen in his 3,600-page report on nuclear reactor safety, some people ask the question, why do the power companies insist upon the protection of the Price-Anderson Act? The Price-Anderson Act limits their liability to $550 million. So any damages that might occur with a nuclear reactor accident would be limited to $550. And the argument is it must be much more dangerous than Rasmussen says, or the companies wouldn't really insist upon this kind of protection. I'm kind of giving you the arguments. There's also the possibility that natural occurrences, such as earthquakes, will so disrupt the operation of plants that lethal amounts of radiation occur. Furthermore, some acts of sabotage are very likely to occur with similar results. In other words, it's not a matter of an accident or a mistake. It's a deliberate effort. And numerous people have taken bazookas and other things into the plants and presented them to the directors of the plants, indicating that you can penetrate all of the security that's supposed to be there. That they say that sabotage is a real possibility. Sabotage is also possible in terms of the processing, the transportation of the waste to be reprocessed, the transportation of radioactive materials to be reprocessed, particularly in the bringing back of reprocessed fuels to the plant. So in the transportation, they say that there is a great possibility of terrorists, saboteurs, seizing quantities of enriched uranium or plutonium, and to use the materials as a threat. All kinds of different ideas as to how easy it is to make a bomb, and I'm not convinced it's as easy as some people think it is, but the argument is that the materials can be obtained. And one writer says that of the 1,600 pounds of plutonium that is transported yearly, or was transported in 74, the normal amount of loss in that transportation expected to be 0.5%. This is the kind of argument that you get. And it's also claimed that the knowledge of what is required to make a nuclear bomb is available to everyone. Another argument is that the radioactive waste from nuclear plants, some of which are dangerous for thousands of years, have been and will be permanent threats to life, and that there is no program for their permanent disposal. Some argue that they're simply sitting above ground now, or buried, covered over, but not really permanently disposed of. In other words, they are in a temporary storage space. Some say there's no possible way to dispose of them safely. Some say there's no adequate program that's been devised to prevent serious pollution from the piles of waste products of uranium mining, the tailings. And those of you who think about uranium tailings and know about the problems of our tailings can really experience this. I think I can experience it more than a lot of people who write about it, even because of the experience here with the huge tailings. And David Comey estimates that for the 1,000 nuclear power plants projected for the year 2000, that 5,741,500 deaths, I don't know how he gets that figure. All these statistics are always questionable. Over 5 million deaths will occur over the next 80,000 years. That seems to be a long time. But nevertheless, there is a problem with the tailings. The development of nuclear fission power, people say, in the United States, leads to the development of nuclear fission power plants in other countries. And along with that go the materials, the technology in some cases to build nuclear bombs. India has 2 reactors and has the capacity to make nuclear bombs. Soon it is claimed many more nations will have the nuclear weapons capacity and will be able to use it to blackmail other countries. I think that's probably the thing that bothers me most, is that within, I would think, 20, 25 years, the proliferation of nuclear weapons is just to be expected on the basis of the proliferation of nuclear power technology. As I understand it, if the laser method of enrichment occurs, it'll be a simple method, a simple process in terms of the amount of investment for other countries to develop that. That's a technical question I throw to these experts. Right now, the cost is prohibitive for most of the countries. They don't have the enrichment necessary to enrich the uranium beyond what the normal use is in order to make a bomb of it. Pollution from the heat given off is another argument, and I'm going to pass over that since I don't think it's too important. Some say that there simply isn't enough uranium if we continue to use uranium in the light water reactor, that will run out within 20 to 50 years, will simply run out of uranium. And what running out is, of course, is a problem in terms of what the costs are. But I spent a couple hours this afternoon figuring out how much uranium is required for one nuclear plant and how much would be required for the energy that we use, electrical energy we use, half electrical energy we used in 73, and by the time you get through, you really require many tons. And of course, part of the problem there is technical too, in terms of how much energy you're going to get out of one ton. I'm trying to indicate that in every case, there's some kind of technical arguments or technical data that's involved. Finally, some argue that there are other much less dangerous or risky alternatives that could be developed and would turn out to be feasible and economic if even a part of what the government has spent in developing nuclear power were available. That's the argument, of course, for solar and for geothermal, chiefly. Now, in reply to these arguments against the use of nuclear fission, I'm just going to bring in some other experts. These arguments, I'm going to bring in a couple of teams, one for and one against. And Fred Schmidt and David Bedansky in the energy controversy, the role of nuclear power, have gone through all of these arguments, and they conclude that there is no really viable alternative for the near future. They argue against the increased use of fossil fuels, which we could, of course, turn to. We could turn to coal. We've got enough coal to last for a long time. They argue against the increased use of coal because of the danger of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they say, assuming that all the other dangers involved in using fossil fuels were surmounted, they think that the effects of increased carbon dioxide are much more of a risk than is nuclear power production. And that's not because they know exactly what was going to happen with the carbon dioxide, but they say nobody knows what will happen in the change in our climate if we increase appreciably the amount of carbon dioxide. So I want to use then a quote from them in kind of summarizing their position on nuclear power. Let me just say, you can get experts, Prize winners on both sides of these issues, and it's very difficult. Sometimes I think you make up your mind and then you go out after the facts. They say the environmental impacts of nuclear power are small. Radioactive emissions are negligible. The fuel does exist for everybody. I think they really have to probably indicate that you go breeder if you're going to say the fuel does exist for everybody over a long time, as over against the present. The breeder breeds fuel, breeder reactors, so that is over against our present reactors which use fuel. The breeder breeds fuel, so it just extends the life of the uranium so far that you almost forget about uranium as running out. There are limits, but it seems that you could go on almost indefinitely. Moreover, they say, we know how to teach those who desire to know how to handle the technology. The waste material and volume is very small, and they say we do know how to take care of it and store it. And they finally say you could just build pyramids like the Egyptians, store it inside. And they're still standing, we could build them, and you could climb their sides, and they would shield you from any of the effects. These two men are physicists at the University of Washington, and I assume they know as much as physicists could who really attended to this. Although, of course, the technical problems are so large that there's a sense in which if you aren't really working on the project, it's hard to know about it. Among the controversial questions, they say, swirling around nuclear power, uppermost in many people's minds is that of reactor safety, and they accept the Rasmussen report. There have been some counter-reports to the Rasmussen report, but largely the counter-reports say that they're a little too conservative about the possibility of an accident and the number of people we kill. But they accept it. I don't know how one accepts that 3,600-page report or rejects it, but they accept it. They say that instead of accepting reports like that, we deal with headlines, brief news items, and we get into all kinds of debates without really taking into account the studies that have been made. My reading would indicate that people who do take into account the studies come down on different sides. Now the other statement I just want to introduce you to is the statement called the Plutonium Economy made by the National Council of Churches, which in a sense represents us. And it represents us like all other representations. It depends upon who's on the committee. It's like our science committee for the village. You know, what they do and the stances they take depend upon the people who are on the committee. You've had enough experiences with committees to know. And I've got the list of the people on this committee, and I don't know all of them. Roger says, well, it's Margaret Mead's position. She was co-chairman of the committee with Rene DeBose, I guess you'd say, DeBose.
And DeBose, he called it
DeBose. Yeah, and then they got a lot of other people on here, scientists and political scientists, and Barbara Ward, and so I guess if you were going to pack up the degrees on people who are one side or the other of this, you'd get, you know, about the same type of degrees and Nobel Prize winners and so forth. But anyway, they say that this doesn't introduce any new argument, but it represents the collective wisdom of this committee. And the National Council did not adopt this, but they made almost no changes in it, and then they referred it to the committee for further study. It doesn't represent the considered judgment then of the Council of the National Council. It represents the considered judgment of the committee the Council appointed to represent. I don't want to misunderstand. But they say, we believe that the proposed plutonium economy is morally indefensible and technically objectionable. At many stages in the nuclear fuel cycle, including reactor operation, fuel transport, reprocessing, fabrication, and waste management, opportunity exists for catastrophic releases of plutonium and other radioactive materials through accident or malice. There is no validated scientific basis for calculating the likelihood and the maximum long-term effects of such releases, nor for guaranteeing that risks will not exceed a particular level. All of the present or planned precautions intended to prevent releases are imperfect and for fundamental reasons are likely to remain so. We fear that the cumulative effect of these imperfections may well be unprecedented and irremediable disaster. In a plutonium economy, moreover, nuclear theft and terrorism, weapons proliferation to both national and subnational groups, and the development of plutonium black market seems inevitable. None of these problems will respect national boundaries, and the difficulties of international cooperation will complicate efforts to contain them. In an effort to suppress nuclear violence and coercion, to limit the spread of illicit nuclear weapons, and to encourage the needed perpetual social stability, the United States and other countries may have to undertake massive social engineering and to abrogate traditional civil liberties. That's one argument I didn't include. The drastic nature of the nuclear threat is apt to elicit a drastic police response. Even these measures, however repressive, might in the end prove ineffective. There is additionally the fundamental ethical question of our right to leave to countless future generations a permanent heritage of radioactive waste products. In producing vast quantities of material so deadly, it will require perpetual vigilance and guardianship. Nuclear power will inject into the future an element of risk comparable to that of our vast store of nuclear arms. These profound biological and social hazards, many without present technological solutions or easily foreseeable solutions, would be incurred in pursuit of small and possibly ephemeral economic advantages. Decisions balancing the risks of the plutonium economy with its benefits are now founded in self-serving economic and technical assessments lacking in analytic quality. They are being hastily made without the full and informed public discussion that decisions of such unique importance require. So I present you the Easter people with an issue which requires our attention. And I invite now any of you, especially the Science Committee, to, in the beginning, to participate in this discussion of attempt to clarify what the issues are and bring more light than heat to bear on what's involved.
The reason that I asked that we have this tonight was that Dr. McClellan would be leaving tomorrow. And in your assessment of this pressing problem, the question always arises, who do you believe in and who is addressing the issue? And there's a lot of prophets, some of them are false, and some are partially false. And many people are disturbed, of course, that many Nobel Prize winners do not agree. You have to realize that Nobel Prize winners are also subject to error. When I get to be dictator, Nobel prizes will only be given to people who are very old and who have an inability to speak very loudly so people can hear them. Because the temptation is very great to speak about subjects which they don't know a damn thing about, but they speak with great authority. And I know quite a few of them, and some of them I have great respect for, and some not so much. Tonight, at least a couple of us will address this issue with some experience. I would recall for you that Arthur Compton, one of the brilliant scientists of this era, in his experiments at the Metallurgical Laboratory in Chicago, said that if this coefficient in his research exceeded unity in July of 1942. And immediately it became obvious to the 70 that were there for this seminar that we had entered a new age in that fission. Energy was a possibility. And in fact, some of them hesitated even to attend under the stands at your alma mater in December when the experiment actually took place to prove the point. But even before they proved that issue, they were already designing reactors at Hanford here in the state of Washington to produce plutonium from which they made some atomic devices. Now, one of those reactors that they, someone, Fermi, in fact, I guess, drew the first one in the back of a matchbook cover, Enrico Fermi. And I spent about 15 years within a mile of one of those reactors, the second or third one built, I guess. And it's only recently that it's closed down. And many, of course, were built since that time. Since these original experiments, there's been a tremendous amount of data that has accumulated on this subject. I imagine it would fill this room. I spent most of my scientific career examining the effects of radiation on living systems, large animals. Some of these experiments have involved the lifetime of some animals. In one experiment that, in fact, Dr. McClellan has also started off his scientific career at Hanford Laboratory, and we are both biologists, however, we have also been exposed to nuclear engineering in a formal and informal training period. And we have contributed, at least in quantity, to the literature over this period of time. Know, I guess, a good deal about what the effects are. Some of these experiments have involved the feeding of radioactive materials to animals. In one experiment, for example, over a period of 11 years to a sheep, every day for 11 years, 7 days a week. Another experiment for a lifetime of pigs, and in other cases, dogs. And in fact, of all the hazards of industry today, there is none that has been examined to the extent that radiation has. It is, so far, probably the safest of industries. And you have, of course, as Al has so well summarized, there are concerns and problems. In 1942 to 1945, many of these scientists who came up with these essentially planned pretty much all of the reactors that are now in operation. They also, as soon as they developed the production reactors, they went in, they started having pile seminars that has nothing to do with hemorrhoids. It has something to do with a pile is a reactor in the old lingo. And most of this is planned. And to go into a peacetime utilization of this production of electricity, the one thing they did not predict was the reaction of people, the acceptance or rejection of the principle in its actual performance. They underestimated this. And I guess it's like Apollo says, you know, how's your wife? And he says, compared to what? And that's sort of what we face here. It's not that I love nukes more, but that I love some others less. Because you have to make choice, and you don't operate without risk. The question comes up, you know, what is the risk? And that's the issue before us. But I'm not going to address these issues. I'd like to hear what Dr. McCollum says about this, because Dr. McCollum has directed one of the large laboratories that examined this, one of the largest laboratories in the world, and has emphasized radiation effects, particularly the so-called fission products that you hear a lot about, the waste from this material. Emphasizing inhalation, but other routes of administration. When he started out, he was the youngest director of a major laboratory, probably in the world. And he has, I think, gained a very valuable perspective on this. And I'd like to hear what he says about it. We have not really discussed this since coming here, although we have worked together on many experiments through the years, especially in early years. I'd like to hear what you say, Roger. The reason we had the meeting was that you'd be here for tonight.
Well,
I get tired of being the lone one here.
If we had discussed this beforehand, we'd had the opportunity for me to tell you that you should have left some things over for me to say. I haven't taken them all. But I think in perhaps kind of a rambling way, it's important to emphasize a point that Leo made in terms of examining who you're listening to and what they have to say. And recall that each one of us is an individual of bias, in my view. We bring to a particular subject the bias, our experience in terms of the environment which we've of the pleasure to live and work, and the people that we have worked with. And certainly, you know, having said that, I'm no different in terms of the bias I bring. The bias I bring, Leo has recounted a portion of that. It's important for you to recognize that from the age of 7 to the age of 26 or 27, I lived within 30 miles of 8 production reactors, some of the largest reactors in the world, that operated with an exceptionally good production record from the standpoint of producing plutonium. And so I bring to you a bias in terms of an individual who's, you know, I've lived next door to nuclear reactors, nuclear power, through all of my formative years. Beyond that, I've lived and worked in terms of with radioactive material for all of my scientific career. In addition, I've had the opportunity during the more recent portions of my career to work with other types of toxic material. So that's a bias that I bring as a starting point, you know, lay out on the table before I tell you anything about where I view the subject. I think it's important to re-emphasize a point that Al made, and that is what is our need in terms of energy? And I'm a pragmatist in terms of how I look at things, and my view is we need energy. It's something that, you know, we can't turn back in terms of our way of life. You know, we talk about conservation. Well, yes, conservation is good, and I'm all for it. But we're talking about very small increments in terms of what we can gain by conservation. As for example, my wife says, well, let's put better insulation in the house, you know, or let's see that all houses have better insulation. What do you think is a turnover time in terms of housing in the U.S.? It's a matter of decades in terms of replacement of housing. Or the same argument, someone says, well, gee, you know, you don't have to live in a 1,500 to a 3,000 square foot home. Look what they do in Japan. You can get by with a house that's 20% as large. Well, sure, perhaps you can. People do it very well. But we can't replace all of the houses in the United States, you know, next year or even the next decade. So that's out as a conservation measure. In terms of the total society and its structure, I think there's just simply no turning back in terms of what can really be gained in terms of conservation. So we are a people who use energy, not only in the U.S., but certainly in the Western world by and large, continuing on into other countries of the world. So we start out, we have to have energy. Now, where do we use energy? I think that's very important to look at the question of where it's used. A portion of it we've used in terms of meeting our needs, in terms of our housing, heating, lighting. It's, in other words, very small amounts of usage scattered all around the country. We use energy in terms of transportation. Of course, that means it's got to be something moving, you know, here, there, across the country, from Minnesota to Washington, or California to New York, whatever. And then we use large amounts of energy, very intensive, in particular locations in terms of industrial activities. Well, I think when you examine this, you have to keep this use pattern in mind as you talk about where you're going to get energy from. It says that, for example, if you live as I do in the southwestern U.S., New Mexico, where we have Albuquerque, 350 days of sunshine a year, solar energy may be great in terms of my heating my home. But in terms of trying to put together a series of collectors and putting together in one place enough energy that I can run, say, an aluminum reduction plant, it simply can't be done. Solar energy at this stage of the technology as we see it today, you simply could not meet that kind of industrial need with something like solar power. The same thing is true in terms of geothermal. About 50 miles from where I live, Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, they're looking at the use of geothermal energy in terms of basically a hot rock concept, in terms of drilling a hole down very deep into the earth, drilling a second hole next to it, fracturing at the bottom, introducing water through one of these, the water being heated in terms of the earth, the heated water coming back to the surface, the heat exchange type technique circulating back through. It's fine for certain developments, but it's not at this stage of our development something you're going to be able to use in terms of major industrial applications. Certainly not anything that's going to work in terms of transportation, for example, where we're, as I said, moving hither and gone. So I see these types of applications at this stage very limited by our technology. Within the current budget for the fiscal year 1977, funding for these activities has been increased by 50 to 75% over what it was the previous year. We're moving ahead about as rapidly as can be expected. Some people would say we, in fact, are putting in more money than the scientists and the technology can really use in a productive manner. So I find the argument rather moot that we simply need more money there. I'm not certain we can absorb any more money into those areas at this point. I think it is unfortunate they didn't receive as adequate a support perhaps in the past as they should have, but you know, we can't cross back over that bridge. So we really look then basically, in my view, at, well, let me examine one other, which is very close to home in terms of at Holden, and that's hydroelectric. And basically, we've dammed up just about all of the streams that we can dam up in generating hydroelectric power. Much of that is intensive in terms of the Pacific Northwest. There just isn't very much left there. So we've used that as far as we can go. So that really comes down then basically to two approaches. One of them is the use of fossil fuels, and the other is the use of nuclear power in terms of looking at the near term. And perhaps we have time later, we can talk about it on a longer term basis, another aspect of nuclear power that would make use not of fission, in terms of fissioning atoms and the release of energy, but fusion, where we would bring atoms together and release very large amounts of energy. So the question then really comes down to fossil fuels and nuclear. I think it's important in terms of looking at these two to examine the question of what are we going to leave in terms of, you know, a heritage. And that was touched on to some extent by Al in terms of the statement from the plutonium economy, which he correctly quoted me in saying I identified that as Margaret Mead's position, because I think it basically was Margaret Mead's position, much in the way the report of a great many committees is fashioned after the hand of the chairman or the co-chairman. And having been a member, I say that having been a member of many committees and a chairman of some, and knowing that very few reports are written by committees, basically things are written by people, by individuals. And that's true whether we're talking about a document, as some very famous documents in terms of history, a book, and committee reports. But I think let's just take that question in terms of what is the heritage, you know, what are we going to leave for future generations? Only I want to turn the question around and let's examine that with regard to fossil fuels. What are we going to leave for future generations in terms of the resources that we have? I will call them really, they are not truly non-renewable, but they're certainly non-renewable in terms of the time frame that you and I think about. The fossil fuels that we enjoy the use of today were created over millions and millions of years. They are a treasure house of materials for future generations. And when I say that, I see them as a treasure house not in terms of our pumping oil out of the ground and refining it and putting it in as gasoline in our automobile and burning it, or as in the northwest corner of the state of New Mexico, where we mine hundreds of tons of coal and feed it into large electrical generating plants in terms of into a furnace, a boiler, to create steam, to drive a steam turbine, to produce electrical power, primarily to send to California, for those of you who are from California to enjoy. And in the process, we turn out carbon dioxide, a little carbon monoxide into the atmosphere and some water. To me, that's a tragedy because we've taken this treasure and used it in that way, and in the process denied future generations the opportunity to use, you know, what is really sort of a miracle of what we have, and that's the bondage between carbon atoms and hydrogen atoms that make hydrocarbons that can be used to produce literally thousands of materials that have applications in our society today in terms of drugs, in terms of just a myriad of products. We ought to leave that resource for future generations. We can't afford, you know, in terms of denying future generations that resource, we simply cannot afford to throw it into a furnace and burn it to produce electrical power today, along with some carbon dioxide and water. And at the same time, well, so let me then shift gears from there, away from that question of heritage, and return to really what is the central issue once we put that aside, and that's the question of risk versus benefit. And the question there, I think, is one of trying to stack up all of those risks that are, and they exist to some degree for each one of these sources of energy, either nuclear or fossil fuels, and then weigh on the other side what society is going to get out of it. And it's true that radiation can cause serious health effects, and these are related in some way to the dose of the material of the radiation that the individual receives. In the same way, we have effects associated with the use of fossil fuels. We have these in terms of the release of byproducts, oxides of sulfur, nitrogen. We also have accidents that occur simply in extracting the material, in the coal mine or in the uranium mine. I've examined a great deal of the evidence on this, and I'd say that from my position, as I see it, over the range of doses for which we have information, that the effects associated with the use of fossil fuel to produce a given amount of energy are substantially greater than those associated with the use of nuclear energy. And I would say further beyond that, that the degree of confidence that I have with regard to the estimates of that risk for radiation are substantially greater than the degree of confidence I have in the estimates of risk associated with the fossil fuels. And then having said there's uncertainty, I have to say that I like most others, I have no really good ideas how I can improve those estimates in terms of how can I reduce the uncertainty associated with them. Because what we are talking about in both cases are very, very small increments of risk. And risk not for unique diseases that can be pinpointed back to that particular energy source, but we're talking about the diseases that are common to mankind across the world in terms of late occurring diseases, primarily the development of cancer or functional disorders in terms of lung disease that occur spontaneously or are produced by a wide variety of materials in our environment. And so I just have to say that this question of the very low doses of exposure associated with modern technology use of either of these, we simply aren't in a position to give very reliable estimates below some certain level. Then I think we finally come to the last question, which is the question of the nuclear blackmail, or what do we do in terms of underdeveloped countries, any country of the world, who may gain access to nuclear material. And I feel that that is a risk that is grossly overestimated, in that, in my view, if I try to adopt the mentality of a terrorist, and that's very difficult for any of us to do, I can readily visualize a lot of ways that are better to create havoc in society than to use nuclear materials. Because I could release into this room a very large quantity of plutonium right now, and you wouldn't have known it. You'd have no way of knowing it. You aren't going to drop out of your chair dead. You're not even going to drop out of your bed dead tomorrow, or the end of this week, or the end of this month. You might, if I had been very skillful in dispersing that plutonium into the air here tonight, you might die of lung cancer, you know, down the road some years. So, but on the other hand, there are a variety of materials that I could have pulled out of my pocket and put into the room that would have had you drop dead in your chairs within a matter of minutes.
Or put you to sleep for a while.
Yeah, so that's, I think the question is one of other approaches there. So I think, as I started out, I said I came to it with some biases. My biases basically come in terms of, for the near term, let's use nuclear power, because I think it's our best and really only option.
But in the meantime, Doctor, don't we have to use the fossil fuels until we can build?
I think we use them, but let's use them as sparingly as possible. Because
we're talking about 20 to 50 years before nuclear.
Oh no, I think we can continue in terms of the present rate of expansion of nuclear power, I think that it's. Let's look at how nuclear power is used. Nuclear power is used basically to produce electrical power, then, which is the transmission, the means by which we get the energy from a central generating site to the individual user place. And I think that we need to continue to expand our nuclear power capability in that area as rapidly as possible. I think at the same time, I think we need to intensify our usage of fossil fuels, to shift it away from the burning at that central location to converting it in terms of, let's go ahead and convert it in terms of gasoline or liquefied gas to tide us over that time period, to get us out of the combustion engine age into some other system of transportation. In other words, what I'm saying is, let's try to have a plan that takes us through the use of fossil fuels and out of the use of fossil fuels as combustion products as quickly as possible. And I think we can do that in something that perhaps is measured in the order of the 2 to 4 decade time period.
I have a question of Dr. McClellan. I've never asked him about this. There was a recent finding that excited many people, indicating that in Oklo-Jabon in Africa, there was an interesting experiment in a natural state in which the conditions were right, so that we had a tremendous reactor in the natural state. It's over a billion years ago. But as a result of it, there were 4 tons of fission product, which is a rather substantial amount of radioactivity. I mean, it's a big hunk of radioactivity, was released, along with a tremendous amount of plutonium. And they seem to have survived that. And I was wondering if you had ever, have you
What are your views on that? You use that as a, have you been involved in arguments as its applicability? Weren't many people around see it.
How many
did you clarify the illustration? What happened?
Well, what happened? The formation was such so that there were...
there was a reactor created with a sustained chain reaction.
Yeah, because of enough plutonium coming to become critical, leaking in.
How many years?
Underground someplace?
How many years ago?
About, they assume about 10 to the 9th years, about a billion, over a billion years ago.
Well,
you
would come back on for semi-facetious in terms of, you know, there are a few people who got the Nobel Prize in physics in terms of, you know, their contribution to discovering nuclear fission and discovering plutonium and, you know, as man, you know, introduced processes and somebody beat them to the gun, you know, by quite a few million years.
10 to the 9th years, they beat Seaborg,
But...
And they also had a few years for those materials to disintegrate.
Yeah.
Their life, their half-life wasn't so...
The other thing I was going to say, we have a risk in another area that is rather substantial, and that I guess most of you accept it. There are some people in Idaho who hesitate to accept it right now, but that's dams. And we have had two rather substantial events in dams collapsing within the last few years in Italy, and then the Johnstown flood. Most of you don't remember that one, late 1800s. But there were, in one case, a wall of water 100 feet high. And there were over 2,000 people lost their lives, and of course, billions of dollars in damage, I suppose, and much land compromised for a substantial period of time. This happened in a small way down in Idaho very recently, in which there is an excess of $1 billion of damage. I don't know who holds the insurance policy on that, or in Italy, or the one in Johnstown. I don't think the private corporation did.
Okay, now can we get some participation from the others?
I'm wondering what you think about a lot of states are proposing rather strict regulations covering that, and I was wondering if you think they're necessary. Like, it seems to me that a lot of people who are doing that are trying to stop the kind of things that are happening with dams, things like that, and I was wondering if you think they're that necessary, or...
Are you talking with regard to nuclear power?
Yeah.
Well, I think that they're, you know, as I listen to people associated directly with nuclear industry in terms of building nuclear power plants today, I think they'd suggest that, you know, they have very stringent regulations to adhere to now, and that these are imposed on a national basis, and that these are adequate to safeguard the public. I personally believe that's a correct position. I think that When we're talking about energy, quite frankly, I don't think there's much room for states' rights. You know, in that energy isn't a state problem. Energy isn't even a regional problem. Energy is a national and a global problem. Therefore, I think it's inappropriate to place variable regulations from state to state on industry that basically is trying to develop plants that can be used, you know, the same one in California, the same basic design in California, Washington, or New Jersey, whatever. So I think that they are already very strict and adequate to safeguard the public's welfare.
You people on campus. You see that particularly the younger generation is more against the development of nuclear reactors. For example, in our area, there used to be one built at Austin, Texas. And it was really the university community that stepped it out. And, the old generation had thought it was safe, but it didn't. And I think a lot of instances, the college and university community, for example,
I think one of the, well, I don't know. I think to some extent that it is true in terms of, if you will, the age relationships on it. Nuclear power has associated with it an extremely severe liability and legacy that it carries along, and that is that it was born as a war baby. The first reactors that were built, there's a plutonium producing, were designed specifically to produce plutonium to be used in, you know, what we say in a nice way, a nuclear device. It was a nuclear bomb. And it was intended to kill people. And that's a legacy that unfortunately nuclear power has to bear, because many people find it very difficult to separate their, what they, you know, heard from their, you know, almost from birth in terms of many people in the country today, in terms of the Big Bang. And I can still remember as a youngster when I lived in Richland, Washington, and it was announced that nuclear weapons had been used in Japan, and it was announced that now they could say why Richland, Washington existed. You know, I was a youngster. I didn't know, you know, why we were there, except my father worked in a big plant, and now we knew what they did in part in that plant. And so I think there's a, you know, there's a psychological element built in there in terms of people. You think about it, and you know, it's the Big Bang, and people dying immediately. But when you talk about reactors, that isn't the way the situation is in terms of what happens, what can happen in terms of an accident. Again, I'll admit a degree of bias. I was involved as an advisor on certain aspects of the Rasmussen report, which examined this question. It's true, it's 3,600 pages, and you know, and that's just the final documentation. There are thousands and thousands that go beyond it. Just reams of computer output on this. But as I've examined it, my only criticism, my major criticism is that it tends to overestimate in some areas the consequences of an accident in terms of what it does is it, and I can say what we did in that report was to try to predict the consequences of a nuclear reactor accident. Unfortunately, because one can predict a number of different kinds of accidents, what was done was to predict the accident that would have the greatest consequences. And so the numbers you see coming out of the report, those are not typical of what might happen with an accident, but they're with a very special kind of accident, the accident that would have the greatest biological cost on it. And so the hazards are really overestimated.
But you do have to admit that there was a fairly systematic attempt to reply to the Rasmussen report by what, the American Physics Society?
Yeah, but again, yes, that's very true. I mean, the American Physical Society commented on it. But I think it's also...
Which they said it was the opposite direction, it was too low.
Yeah, but let's back up one second in terms of looking at reports today, and this is a very important lesson in this. Is that unfortunate, well, let me say the fortunate part of it. The process today in terms of not only relative to nuclear power, but environmental issues by and large, is a very participatory type of a process. Now you can argue that it's difficult to figure out what the heck the process is and how you get in there to participate, but there's a lot of emphasis placed on getting public participation. And part of that process is that you don't issue a report, but you start out by issuing a draft report. And a couple of reports I've been associated with, we issued the draft report, yeah, and then a draft on the draft, and a draft on the draft.
In other words, you were a kind of consultant, and they wanted you to agree or disagree with some things.
No.
In the draft, or did you
no,
draft?
No, you're drafting the report. You go through an iteration on it, and now you put it out for public comment.
And the public comes back and they say, hey, you know, how about this, how about that? That's what the American Physical Society did. They made some good points, and those were taken into account in the second report.
I just wanted you to admit there were some, some problems.
Well, sure, have you ever written a first draft of a manuscript that was perfect?
This thing is about the fourth draft.
Yeah, you know, and so that's what happened, yeah. And I think that's good. You know, the lid wasn't closed.
If you had representatives from that committee that made their report, you two would then get involved in the kind of technical discussion most of us couldn't get involved in, maybe a few of us. And that's the thing that really bugs me about this whole thing. You kind of turn it over to technicians, and we poor lay people are really dependent. I've had people say, well, we just got to depend on the technicians, and I refuse to bow. Somehow we cannot let this society be run by our technicians, and yet there are technical problems involved. It's really a very difficult issue.
But don't you think, though, that some of your technicians are a heck of a lot smarter than lots of us in society that think we have the answer to all the environmental issues?
I mean, the Pentagon, in terms of Vietnam, I mean, we had the smartest guy in the country. And if you read Halverson's book on the best and the brightest, they're the ones who kept feeding us false information with all their computers and all their lines out. They just fed us a bill of goods, didn't they?
They might have been the smartest, but they had the least experience, and I think an item in that book really points it out.